Ladies and gentlemen, and members, we will call this property tax relief, local sales tax division, order. And I'd like to thank everyone for their patience. Before we go any further, we've got three sets of minutes to approve, and so we'll do that right now. Do I hear a motion to approve of the March 5th and March 28th and April 4th, 2008 minutes? Do I hear a motion to that effect? Representative Dietrich moved that. Is there any discussion on that? If not, motion to approve those three sets of minutes. All those in favor say aye. Those opposed say nay. The motion prevails. We're here to go over the property tax division report. And just a couple comments before we start. I first of all want to thank members for their participation in the last couple of years. There's a number of items in this bill that are from actually last year, things we worked on there, but I want to sincerely thank members for their input as we've gone on the last 2 years, and that certainly has culminated into this bill. Also, very much want to thank staff for all the work in putting things together and having things ready to go for tonight. I appreciate all of that. You know, a major focus, of course, of this division is to provide property tax relief. And even though we were not able to accomplish that last year, the problem hasn't gone away. Since 2002, between 2002 and 2008, property taxes statewide have gone up 59%. And for homeowners, that tax increase is 82% from 02 to 08. And if we go with the projected increase on homeowners in 09 and we do nothing, that will be a 90% increase on homeowners in the last 7 years. This year, in 09, we're looking at another $559 million of property tax increases. And so lots of pain and lots of property tax increases are on the horizon if we do nothing. So as we look to put this together, in looking at providing property tax relief, there was a very strong direction from our tax chair, Representative Lemkeski, who has stated over and over again in the last couple of years how she wants a progressive system. So as we look to reduce property taxes, the strong direction was to also do it in a progressive fashion. And I think this bill, while it significantly reduces property taxes, it does also make a fair and more progressive tax system. And we'll have staff go over the bill, but I'd like to cover just a couple of the major points. And of course, the centerpiece of this bill is something that we had in the bill last year. I think it had strong support from this division last year. I would expect it would again this year. And that is direct property tax relief. But not just direct property tax relief, but targeted, focused property tax relief based on the ability to pay that goes out to those who need it the most. And if you look at a $559 million problem with property tax increases, there's no way we can take all of that in one bite. So what we've decided to do is to focus on those who have had the greatest burden of the property tax increases placed upon them, and that is your homeowners. 82% increase in the last 6 years. So this tax, property tax relief plan, targets our senior citizens, our families, and our farmers who have really put the bill in the last 6 years and provide them the most property tax relief. And how we do that is through a homestead credit state refund, which is basically says that if you have property taxes that are more than 2% of your income, you're eligible to qualify for a homestead credit state refund. This year's plan, it's a 2% threshold. We go up to about $200,000 income, household income, which is an increase from 150 to 200,000. That's probably getting to 96 or 97% of your households. And what we do with that, it's based on the ability to pay, of course, and it's targeted to those who need it the most. How we fund that, it is a revenue neutral approach on the Homestead Credit State Refund, in that we look at the five state direct relief property tax programs. So you have the property tax refund program, the circuit breaker. You have the market value homestead credit. You've got the itemized income tax property tax deduction. You have the renter's credit, and you have targeting. Those are the five programs in our state where money is provided directly to the homeowner that helps reduce property taxes. And what we've done is we've restructured those first three, the property tax refund program, the market value homestead credit program, and the itemized property tax income deduction, into a more beneficial, more efficient, more focused homestead credit state refund that targets and directs direct relief to property tax owners based on their ability to pay and based on their need. So that is the centerpiece of this property tax reform package. It's revenue neutral. We think it's a viable, very viable, doable plan. A couple of other things that are in this, I think you could also consider this a homeowner protection bill, in that there are some items in here that really get to some of the areas that have been concerned as of late. And if you look at foreclosures, for example, which has been really huge, is that there are three provisions that will help out with foreclosures. One is, now the assessor, if you've got an area that might have five or six vacant homes that have been foreclosed in the neighborhood, right now assessors, they can't use that and put that into consideration. This bill will allow assessors to take into account foreclosed homes in the neighborhood. A second area that it deals with, it will allow that if you come in and you purchase the house that was foreclosed, that if you do improvements, you will get a tax break, much like the old, this old house. So it will allow you to make some of these improvements and not have to pick up all the property taxes all at once. And the third major area when it deals with foreclosures has to do with cities. There's a $1 million grant in that we realize that cities with a high concentration, or parts of cities with high concentrations of foreclosures, are facing a lot of increased law enforcement costs, inspection costs, zoning costs. We set aside a $1 million for grant, maximum of $250,000 per city. One other area I want to talk about is dealing with assessments. We've talked about, you know, property taxes, the one area where the government is involved on both ends, not only sets the rate at the end, like you see with income and sales tax, but it also sets up the parameters at the beginning, which income and sales do not. And so what we've done is we think we have put some things into this bill that will increase accountability, accessibility, openness in the assessment practices, and allows for a group of citizens. If they think the assessment practices have not been good in their area, they can appeal to the Department of Revenue, and the Department of Revenue will take a look at the situation. We've also, for those who really want to know what's on those field cards and have a lot of information, they want all of that, that will have to be placed very, I guess, out there on that assessment form that goes out, even internet sites. And finally, on openness, it would require a board to review to stay open until at least 7 p.m. to make it easier. So those are some, I think it's not just the property tax relief bill, it's a homeowner's protection bill. And I guess it all comes down to this, that a lot of people might ask, you know, why do a relatively large property tax relief bill when we've got a $935 million deficit? And I say this is exactly the time to do it, because it's times when you have tough economic times where you need a program based on the ability to pay, because no senior citizen who has lived in their home for 50 years, or a family who's raised their children in a neighborhood, in a school district, should be forced out of their home or neighborhood because a spouse dies or a spouse loses their job. This protects homeowners and by keeping ability to pay and keeping things on an even level. So kind of with that set out, what I'd like to do is to begin with the overview. And I'm thinking we'll start with Mr. Michael in Article 1, or who's in Ms. Nancy, who's going to do Article 1. And members, as they go through, is that all right if they ask questions while you're going through? Very good. So, members, this is your chance to do that. For all those hearing, there is no testimony tonight. We have a pretty, even though we're meeting after session on Wednesday, I think we have a pretty time certain in that I think we'll be meeting at 6:30, and I think that is a very time certain on Wednesday. And so not only will that be time for testimony, but also time for markups and amendments and so forth. So with that, Ms. Manzi?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Nina Manzi from the House Research Department. Article 1 is the Homestead Credit State Refund. A lot of this will look very familiar to you, as a great deal of this article is very similar to what was in last year's division bill. This article, as Chair Marquardt noted, takes the three existing homeowner property tax relief programs, other than the targeting program, and replaces them with a new Homestead Credit State Refund program. It phases out the market value homestead credit over a five-year time period. It replaces the existing homeowner property tax refund or circuit breaker with the new homestead credit state refund. And it eliminates the state income tax deduction for real and personal property taxes. The first section of the article is the phase out of the homestead market value credit. In the summary, it shows you the phase-out schedule. So not the homestead market value credit, the market value. No, it is the homestead market. It is. I think it's worded incorrectly in the summary. I think it maybe is the market value homestead credit, and perhaps Mr. Hines can correct. Oh, he says either way. Good. Okay. I've had a rough time over the last week with the words changing order in some of these terms. So the existing credit, which is tied to the value of the home and not to the owner's ability to pay, will be phased out over a five-year period. It will remain in effect at 100% for the first year, and then it works its way down until taxes payable in 2014, when the credit would no longer be allowed. The second section is a technical section relating to what appears on the property tax statement, so that the market value credit amount will remain there during the phase-out period and then be removed after that. The third section of the article is the one that provides the revenue to fund the new refund by disallowing the income tax deduction for real and personal property taxes paid. Current law requires individuals to add back the state taxable income, the federal itemized deduction for state income taxes paid, and this would expand that to also apply to real and personal property taxes paid. When people who itemize make this add back, the state has a calculation that in effect preserves for them the standard deduction for their filer status. So what you do on this little worksheet is to figure the difference between your taxes that have to be added back and your total itemized deductions, and compare that to the standard deduction amount so that you never have to add back more than the difference. And there's an example, if your total tax deduction is $15,000 and your property tax deduction were $5,000, if your standard deduction, the standard deduction for a married couple is $11,300, so you don't have to add back the whole $5,000, you just have to add back the difference between the $15,000 and the $11,300. This has the effect of making you into a standard deduction filer for state purposes. So the way this would work is that first you would figure the add back for your state income tax, and then whatever was left above the standard deduction of real and personal property taxes, you would then go on to add that back. Sections 4 and 5.
Representative Lanning,
can we ask questions along the way?
Absolutely, please do.
a question here with regard to this loss of deductibility. I assume that it applies both to the homesteaded and seasonal rec, non-homesteaded. And so people who own both a homesteaded property and a seasonal rec are going to be affected more by this provision. They're going to lose the deduction for both.
Ms. Nancy? Mr. Chair, Representative Lanning, that's correct. And that would still be subject to the preservation of the standard deduction amount. I think maybe in my example I should have noted that there are a lot of filers who are already pushed down to the standard deduction amount by the add back of the state income tax deduction. So what happens is that about, for homeowners, and this doesn't, you know, totally take into account the people who maybe own a seasonal recreational property and not a home, but for homeowners in the state, about there's roughly 1.5 million, and about 1 million of them currently claim the itemized deduction for property taxes paid. The rest are either standard deduction filers or else their income is below the income tax filing threshold. So we've got 1 million of the 1.5 million, roughly, and I'm rounding these, who claim itemized deductions. Of those 1 million, about 750,000 of them have a state tax benefit as a result of deducting property taxes at the federal level. The other 250,000 have their itemized deductions reduced to the standard deduction amount by the state income tax add back. And again, that's a rough number to put it in context of all the homeowners in the state.
Just one follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one follow-up question. So if I understand this correctly, the owners of seasonal rec, if they also own homestead, lose their deduction, but they're obviously not eligible for any of the property tax relief on the seasonal rec, only on their homesteaded. So the relief we're giving to other homesteaded property would not accrue to those who own seasonal rec, further seasonal rec property.
Ms. Danzy? Mr. Chair, Representative Lanning, that's correct. I think there may be some provisions in the property tax article that relate specifically to seasonal recreational property, but they're not part of the bill. They're not part of this proposal for property taxes.
Thank you. And Ms. Nancy, that would involve filers who itemized and did not do the standard deduction, so it wouldn't include all those. And also, if you are seasonal rec, you could also qualify under county program aid, township aid, probably not local government aid, but there may be other ways in which you property owners would see some reduction. Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You said that a single standard was 11,000 in round numbers.
Ms. Nancy?
Mr. Chair, Representative Earhart, the standard deduction for a married couple filing jointly is 11,300. The standard deduction for a single filer, and these numbers are for tax year 2009, is 5,600 and, let's see, half of 11,300, so I think it's $5,650.
Well, Representative Earhart.
Mr. Chairman, let's assume I'm married, which I'm not. Does that mean if I had 11,000 years of property taxes, which I do, that I would get no... I'd be paying the full vote on that 11,000 as far as the state taxes go, because you're adding the whole works back in it.
Ms. Nancy.
Mr. Chair, Representative Earhart, it would depend on what the total amount was of your other itemized deductions also, and how much of that was your state income tax deduction. If you're let's try an example. If you had state income taxes of, say, $5,000 and you had charitable contributions of $1,000, so now we're up to $17,000 in total itemized deductions. And we'll assume that you're married and you're eligible for the $11,300 standard deduction. Under current law, you have to add back the state taxable income, the $5,000 that is your state income tax deduction. So of your $17,000 in total deductions, you're already adding back $5,000 of it, which brings you down to $12,000. Then you would...
Okay. Thank you. Anyway, thank you, Ms. Manzi. You may continue.
Sections 4 and 5 are...
Representative Earhart, I mean, did you...
I need a pencil and paper.
Okay, all right. All right, very good.
I can follow up on that. Sections 4 and 5 are technical sections that correct references in the homeowner property tax statute and in the targeting statute so that the definitions will work with the new proposed homestead credit state refund. Section 6 is the new homestead credit state refund. If you look in the bill language, it provides the schedule there for the refund. Under the refund program, people, homeowners who have property taxes that exceed 2% of their household income and have household income of less than $200,000 are eligible to claim a refund. The refund will equal a percentage of the taxes that are in excess of 2% of their income up to a maximum amount. So this is an ability to pay refund. If you have taxes that are very large relative to your income, you will be eligible for a larger refund than someone who has taxes that are small relative to their income. If your taxes are less than 2% of your income, then you're not eligible for a refund under this program. The maximum refund will be $2,500 compared to the current property tax refund program maximum, which is $1,810. And these are for taxes payable in 2009. It also extends to a much higher income than the current property tax refund program. It extends to $200,000, and the current program extends to just under $100,000. The refund percentages under the new refund are larger for all income levels than are the refund percentages under the current property tax refund program. So except for a couple of income ranges at very low income, people who are eligible for the new refund will be eligible for a larger refund than they may claim under the current program. Section 7 authorizes the commissioner to provide a table in the instructions for the new refund amount. Section 8 provides for the income ranges and the maximum refund amounts for the new homestead credit state refund to be indexed annually for inflation. And currently the property tax refund program for homeowners and renters are both indexed for inflation. This separates the two because the renter refund program will continue to be indexed for inflation, but it will be going off a different base year than the homeowner program. Section 9 repeals the existing homeowner property tax refund since that's being replaced by the new homestead property tax refund.
Thank you very much. Anyone else? Questions for Article 1? Ms. Nancy, thank you very much. Article 2 is dealing with aids and credits. Another key component of this property tax relief bill is to maintain a strong relationship, a strong state and local relationship. So there is a $30 million increase in local government aid, $20 million increase in county program aid in each year, and reinstating $3 million to township aid. Ms. Dalton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee. It's been a long day already. For the record, I'm Pat Dalton from House Research, and I'm joined by
Steve Hines from Home Research.
Chair Marquardt already pretty much covered the overview, which is that the Article 2 increases aids and credits, basically aids to cities, towns, and counties. The LGA appropriation is increased by $30 million, and there is a modification of the distribution formula. County program aid is increased by $20 million, and there is a new town aid program of $3 million. In addition, there is a one-time grant program in 2009 only for cities to help cities with costs associated with concentrations of home foreclosures. And at the very end, there's also a study group consisting of legislators and local government officials to study general aid to local governments and report recommendations for changes by December 15, 2010. And that study group is actually what was in last year's veto tax bill. So, briefly, the city LGA formula, the modification is, if people recall the Unity bill that was introduced, Representative Marquardt introduced it, but it was the bill that had been suggested by all the city groups with a funding of $90 million. This is a modification of that Unity plan. It kind of kludges together the Unity bill and also the volatility fixes that were included in Chapter 154 that have already passed. So one of the big differences between the Unity bill and what's in here is that aid is not grandfathered into the future. The formula will continue to work into the future. So that's probably the biggest difference. Section 1 states that we're going to, beginning in 2010, city's revenue needs will be based on an average of 2 years worth of data. Under the volatility fix in Chapter 154, your formula aid was based half on 1 year's worth of data and half on the previous year's worth of data. That's hard to do with some of the other things that were in the Unity bill. So that's been removed, and this is what's replacing it. So there's still more of knowledge of what's going to happen, and it's going to smooth out the variations in the revenue needs. Section 2, the city aid base of the grandfathered aid. It eliminates an obsolete reference to aid that Coon Rapids was getting through 2008. That's ended, so that's been removed. The extra aid for small cities is removed, and that's replaced with the new small city aid base in Section 3. That's identical to the Unity bill. It does not remove the regional center aid that was in the Unity bill. That removal was in the Unity bill, and I'll talk about that a little bit more when we get to the job space aid. And finally, it provides extra aid for the following cities. Browns Valley and Crookston, both related to some flooding issues. Those were both in the veto tax bill last year. $80,000 a year for 10 years for the city of Mendota, which was a bill you heard this year, and $100,000 annually to the city of Excelsior related to the costs associated with their public park. And that's $100,000 instead of the $250,000 that Excelsior asked for. Section 3 is the small city aid base. This is essentially what was proposed in the Unity bill, but it's been scaled down. The Unity bill had $12 per capita in small city aid base, which was an increase of $6 per capita. Because this only has an appropriation of $30 million instead of $90 million increase, this has also been scaled down to thirds, so the small city aid base is $8 per capita. City jobs base, here's another place where there's been some modification from the Unity bill. It does establish a separate city jobs base for all cities with a current population of 5,000. Again, the amount given on a per capita multiplied by the jobs per capita has been reduced by about two-thirds, so from $55 per capita down to $18 per capita. Some of the bells and whistles that had existed in that have been removed, and instead, because they're keeping regional center aid, cities that were getting the maximum regional center aid have their city jobs base reduced by 25% of their regional center aid, and that allows you to distribute money in a similar fashion without having carrying different aids per capita and, you know, making extra payments to different cities based on different size. County transit, and I'm going to let Steve talk about Section 5.
Mr. Chair, Section 5 provides for county transition aid in 2009 and thereafter equal to the amount of transition aid in 2007, and that is about $460,000 of aid that goes to about a half dozen counties that did not, basically didn't fare well under the conversion from Old County Hackett to the new county program aid. In addition, Section 5 provides for $100,000 for 2009 only to Pine County in reference to a help pay for a court-ordered courthouse revisions, and this was in the vetoed tax bill from last year, and then also provides for 3 years, $250,000 each year for Beltrami County to help with out-of-home placement costs.
Section 6 is the new town aid. It's basically a dollar amount per capita, which translates into roughly $2.85 per capita, but to make sure that some of the smaller cities that are primarily ag and have very low population get some money. Everyone gets $100 off the top, so every township gets $100, then they get their $2.85 per capita. For unorganized townships, the money goes to the counties, and the counties get $100 plus $2.85 times the population in all of the unorganized townships in the county. And that's because counties provide township services to the unorganized townships. Section 8, as I said, we're eliminating the provision that says, oh, I'm sorry, Section 7. Let's do these in order. This is essentially the same as what was in the Unity Bill. The Formula 8 is now equal to the sum of the city's job base, its small city aid, and a percentage of the difference between its need minus its ability to pay. The formula cannot be less than zero. Mm-hmm. As in the Unity Bill, the Pay 2009 formula distribution will be based on the 2008 data. Beginning in 2010, as I said, the revenue need will be based on 2 years' worth of data, and it will be based on the data that's available as of January 1 of the year in which the aid is certified, which means we will know all of the data when we are sitting here in committee talking about what the distribution is. There won't be any surprises after the session has adjourned and everyone has gone home.
When is that occurring, Ms. Dole?
And that begins in...
No, I mean when we're adjourning and going.
Well, hopefully sooner rather than later.
All right.
Mr. Chair. Section 8, city distribution. As I said, we eliminate the provision that says half of your aid is based on your formula aid from last year and half is based on your formula aid from this year. As I said, that's been replaced with the two-year average for need. We also provide that a city's maximum increase in 2009 is 25% of its levy in the previous year. We always have to raise that every time we put a substantial amount of new aid in there, just so you don't have a bounce back effect because some people hit the cap in the first year and then the next year the money shifts back. And for anyone who was here in 2005, you know how devastating that was for some people when that happened. And then the other thing is there is an adjustment to the maximum aid loss for small cities in 2009 only because of to make sure that it can handle the elimination of the small city aid. There was a number of very, very high valued cities with very, very high tax bases. Example is North Elk that were getting aid under the old small city formula. This way they can actually go to zero now. So small cities who have substantial tax base will not get aid in the future. Section 9 is the appropriation for all of the aid programs. As I said, LGA appropriation increases by $30 million to $515 million a year.
And county program aid increases by $20 million each year. There's the two different aspects of the county program aid, the need-based and the tax-based equalization, and each of those is going up by $10 million per year. And they're approximately split equally right now, so it just maintains that balance between those two parts of the formula.
And there's also the $3 million appropriation for town aid. And finally, there is the one-time only appropriation of $1 million to pay for grants to cities under Section 10, the next section, which is the city foreclosure grants. And what this program does is it requires the Commissioner of Revenue to work with the Commissioner of the Housing Finance Agency to develop a measure or to work with how to measure this. But basically, for a city to qualify for a grant, either the whole city or a zip code within the city, for a city that has multiple zip codes, has to have a foreclosure rate that is 50% higher than the average foreclosure rate in the 7-county metro area. All the areas that who apply for that grant and qualify, the money is distributed based on the number of foreclosures in each of their qualifying area compared to all the qualifying areas, with no city being able to get a grant of more than $250,000. And the money has to be used for inspection and public safety costs associated with the foreclosures. And as I said, Section 11 is the final section, and that's the aid study that was in last year's veto tax bill.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Ms. Dalton or Mr. Hines?
And Mr. Chair, there are county, township, and city LGA runs in everybody's packet.
Very good. Thank you very much. We are now moving to Article 3, property taxes. And before we do that, all of you in your packet should have a DE1 amendment with an A1 amendment to that. And what I'd like to do is move that now so we have something to go off of. So at this time, I'll move the H-1222-DE1 amendment. Do I hear any discussion of that? If not, I'm going to call for the vote. Get things in proper form. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, the motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. And then I would like to add an author's amendment, the A1 amendment. I'd like to move that. Is there any discussion there? Not, I'll call for the vote on the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The motion does prevail. The amendment is adopted. Thank you. Ms. Baker, Article 3, property taxes.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we're going to do Article 3, myself and Steve Hines. The first section, and I'm starting on page 22 of the bill, or I'm starting on page 7 of the summary. The first one is rate adjustment, and this is just requiring the PUC, or the Public Utility Commission, to adjust the utility rates for any property tax changes that get made to the utility class rates. And this is exactly the same provision that was in the veto tax bill, and it allows them to make these adjustments outside of the general rate case. The next section, the chair already mentioned a little bit about, I think. It adds some additional powers and duties to the Commissioner of Revenue and has the Commissioner assist local assessors in valuing industrial special use property. This is property which is caused a lot of issues and has been a real problem for local assessors. And the definition is that it's uniquely designed and equipped for a particular industry. It's not easily adapted to another use. It has facilities of at least 75,000 square feet and has a value of at least $10 million based on the assessor's preliminary determination. So the idea here is that the assessor would make a preliminary determination and then the Commissioner of Revenue would assist the local assessor and help him review it, he or she review it, as to how they arrived at it and some of the basic issues that the assessor is having. The next section is a provision that was in the veto tax bill. It's Fergus Falls Historical Zone. It exempts property that's located on the site of the former Regional Development Center. In Fergus Falls, and it has a 15-year property tax exemption, and then in the last 3 years there's a phase-in that, like I said, that's the same as the veto deal. Section 4 is a provision which was Representative Hackbarth. That also was in the veto deal, and it is exempting the attached machinery and personal property that is for a new proposed facility that's being built in the city of Elk River in Sherburne. And this is pretty standard language. I think there's been, you know, probably 20 of these that have been exempted over the past 10, 15 years. So this is very standard. The next section 5, this is one of the three provisions, and you'll see there's three different sections that are from the chair's House File 4020, where he was trying to address various assessment practices and issues. This one is really replacing that provision on rotation of assessors that was talked about, and there was some real concern as to having assessors rotate on valuation. And what this does is it requires the commissioner of revenue to review assessment practices within a taxing jurisdiction if they get a request in writing, and it's by the greater of, and it says 5 property owners or 1% of the property owners in the jurisdiction. The reason why, in the case of like 5 property owners, is if you had a township that was really having a lot of issues, you know, 5 might be a very large part of the number of property owners in that township. And so this, although it looks like a very small number, that's what it's really geared for. And it's for the commissioner to then review it and report the findings to the board and to the affected city council or town board, and also to let the property owner that was designated to send in this request, the report on behalf of those signing the request, to notify them and report back as to what the commissioner found. The next section is a provision that just puts in statute to make it very clear that the assessors shall take into account the market value effects of foreclosed properties on all properties that are in the vicinity due to the foreclosures. And it makes a very straightforward statement that this should be taken into account. The next section 7 is a provision which was Representative Otremba's a couple years ago, and there's been a lot of changes made to it. But the purpose of this one is that if you have ag land which also touches some public waters, that until you've done some kind of developing of that small strip of land that is along the waters, that the assessor can't value that higher land or that land that's touching the water at anything other than ag land and or in the case of rural vacant land. And we'll talk about the rural vacant land a little bit later. Steve's going to cover that one. Basically what this does is if in fact the farmer doesn't develop this land, nothing is going to happen. But if the farmer does develop it, then the assessor has this highest and best use and the value that the taxpayer has paid, and there's going to be a payback. And it's 7 years. The actual payback is equal to 7 times the average of the difference between what they paid in the current year and the previous 2 years versus what they would have paid had it been valued at that higher number. And that's effective for pay 2010. So,
Section 8 is a provision based on Representative Broad's bill with some amendments to it that puts a limit on the amount that your value can grow for homes that have either been through a foreclosure process or that are located in a disaster or emergency area and sustained damage of at least $5,000. The idea is that you would look if those a home in either of those situations gets restored by the new or by the owner, that they would get to phase in their new value over a 4-year period, provided that the living area of the house does not exceed 130% of what it had been before the foreclosure or the disaster. Section 9 is from the Green Acres bill of Representatives Conan and Demmer, and it the first part of it references Section 20, which is where some of the changes take place. And the major thing I want to mention in Section 20 right now is that basically it breaks down what's currently all sort of considered to be ag property into two subclasses, one of which is agricultural land and buildings, and the other one of which is called rural vacant land. And that's a terminology that gets used in a few places in this bill. And basically Section 9 says that from this point forward, only property that's agricultural land can qualify for green acres, not rural vacant land. However, there's a grandfather provision provided so that no property that's currently in the program is taken out of the program as a result of this bill. Section 9 also eliminates the minimum income requirement for green acres and reduces the minimum acres requirement from 10 acres to 3 acres. And it eliminates a difficult provision to administer that had to do with the definition of primarily devoted to agricultural.
Mr. Hines, while you're taking a breath, I do really want to thank Representative Demmer and Representative Conan for their work on this Green Acres area, so I really appreciate that.
Mr. Chair, Section 10 then is the grandfather provision, which I've already described. It says that basically anybody that's currently in the program is allowed to remain in the program until their normal termination conditions are met, that the property is sold or transferred in whole or in part, or it ceases to be used for agricultural purposes. Section 11 is a provides for the department, the Commissioner of Revenue, to develop a method for determining the agricultural value of properties in Green Acres, and this has been a problem that the department has identified as a lack of uniformity across the state. So they really have already developed this methodology, and it's been a lot of it has been field tested or being disseminated to the assessors with some feedback. This methodology is largely in place. Paragraph B has a provision for what to do with the non-agricultural property that's in Green Acres, and this would, under the bill, now be only the rural vacant land that's included because of the grandfather provision. And this provides that rather than trying to determine an agricultural use for property that has no agricultural value, that instead you just look at the value it has at this point in payable 09 and increase it each year by an average growth rate, since you're just carrying that property along till it runs out of the program, basically. Section 12 is a technical section. Section 13 is a significant one, and it increases the payback provision in Green Acres currently at 3 years and makes it now a 7-year payback provision, so that when a whole or a part of a property is taken out of the Green Acres program, they have to pay 7 years of back taxes on the difference between the high and the low value. Sections 14 and 15 are technical, and Section 16 is not Green Acres.
The next section is a property tax credit for property that's in bovine tuberculosis management zones, and this is a provision of Representative Owens, and it has two different property tax credits. One is Subdivision 2, which is a credit that's on ag land for cattle herds, and it's for the full amount of the property taxes on the land where the property owner has eradicated a cattle herd that was kept on the land for at least part of that year in order to prevent the onset or spread of bovine TB. The second one is another property tax credit, which is very similar, but this one is for on hunting land, and this has to do with deer and elk herds. And this one is a little tighter because what it says is the property tax credit, you're only eligible if the property owner or Department of Natural Resources has eradicated the deer or elk herd. The property owner adheres to strictly to deer and elk feeding band, and the property owner makes every effort to keep their land free of the deer and elk. So it's a different type of criteria in order to qualify, but it is equal to the full tax on the parcel where the deer or elk herd have been located, and just on the land only.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm just wondering, is the land infected or the bovine? Why are we giving a tax credit for land when the cattle are the, or whatever else, elk and deer are there, things that are infected? I don't follow the logic.
Ms. Speaker?
Mr. Chair, Representative Earhart, you asking for on subdivision 2 or 3 or both of them, really? The cattle or the deer? Are you asking just on the deer and the elk herds?
Wherever you got bovine TV.
Oh, because I think the idea with the cattle herds, of course, is that you can't have cattle there until that area has been declared. There's a term here that the U.S. Department of Ag has to certify that the state's bovine TB status is upgraded to a certain level, so you can't bring cattle back on. Now, in the case of the deer and the elk herds, I think the idea was that that hunting land, which people have bought for hunting, now can't be used for hunting, and so the land becomes, you know, semi kind of worthless until you've reached the point where you can let the deer and elk come back to hunt, so that you can hunt again.
Mr. Chairman, you were saying the land, which is my question, is the land is infected.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
you know, if somebody can't Mr. Chairman can't rebuy a herd or let cattle run on it again, I don't see what that has to do with. There, maybe you have a credit. I just don't think that you give property tax. I don't know. It doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah, and this is also area that's in that management zone. I mean, it's within that zone area. But it also, Paul Cummings has worked an awful lot with this because this is Representative Olensville, but he also mentions that this is one way that will create an incentive for the hunters to work with the DNR in trying to eradicate the deer or elk that might be in this area. But Representative Demmer, did you have something?
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you. I was just going to say that, you know, to, I don't know if it's fair to have Ms. Baker or Mr. Hines having to rationalize what we've come up with. They're just putting in the language. So I was just going to say, Mr. Chair, maybe you should be answering Mr. Earhart, rather than Ms. Baker. That's all I was going to say.
Well, Mr. Chairman, you know, I'm just trying to figure out why we're giving a credit for to the land for something that the land has nothing to do with.
I would disagree with that though, because they've identified an area, a zone. I think it's within 10 miles of the counties where they have found the bovine TB. We're trying to eradicate it because it has huge impact on the rest of the state. And basically what you're doing, either with the cattle or with the deer, is you're asking people to give up the use of their land to be able to help with this project. And so we're feeling that we give a credit to the land because that's what's being impacted here,
well,
the person's ability to use that.
To me, the land could be put to other use. In some cases where the pasture could be plowed and something else planted there. If you're saying that a tree transmits a bovine TB, then I understand. Or rocks or whatever is in the, you know, pasture. Anyway, I don't want to belabor it. It just seems like an odd way to give.
Anything else, Representative Demmer?
Well, Mr. Chair, the only comment I would make is I think Representative Olin was questioned about this particular thing, and a lot of the property up there is really not suitable for any other use, I think is what his testimony was regarding that. Otherwise, I would probably agree with Representative Earhart, other than the fact that Representative Olin's testimony was that it's not usable for other things.
Very good. Get your amendments ready, Representative Earhart. Ms. Baker, please continue.
Okay. Moving on to Section 17, that is one other portion of the Chair's bill on the assessment issues, and that requires the valuation notice to provide information about the availability of data used by the assessors to determine the value of property, including really just location of where the information is, the times when the locations are open to the public, and the county's website. And this is just to make easier taxpayer access to the county assessor's office and times and availability. The next provision, Section 18, is Representative Brown's bill that allows ag property to be homesteaded. This is on the relative ag homestead. If the person occupying the property is a brother or sister of the owner, currently homestead treatment is allowed if we have a son or daughter, father or mother, grandson or granddaughter, and what's being added here is the brother or sister. Down in Section 19, this provision of Representative Brown's also carries down into the special ag homestead provisions. And then in addition to that, the other change that is made is for, it's redefining really the concept of the proximity that shows there in Clause 4, which neither the owner nor the person farming the land live farther than four townships or cities from the property. That was a provision Representative Marquardt had in the veto, well, it was actually in the House version, and it didn't ever make it to the veto bill, but it was in the House version as passed. And what this does is it now requires that this auxiliary land be located anywhere either in the same county or an adjacent county rather than the current standard within that core township or city area. So it broadens it to the contiguous counties.
Section 20 is, again, it has to do with agricultural classification, and much of this was in the Green Acres bill, although there's some parts of other bills as well. I already alluded to the split between the agricultural land and buildings, which is now Class 2A, and then Class 2B, which is rural vacant land. Now, these two types of property have the same class rate and class rate structure of 1% if they're non-homestead, or the tier structure that's in place for ag homesteads. Ag homestead must contain some agricultural land and buildings, and then adjacent contiguous rural vacant land is kind of how the ag homestead would be treated. Other things down in the third paragraph, there's currently a 10-acre minimum requirement for property to classify as agricultural. That's eliminated, and there is a new test, though, for property of less than 5 acres that isn't in the summary, but there is a further test for the assessor to apply for these smaller parcels that looks at whether it really is agricultural or not. There's a changing in the definition of agricultural purposes to bring in some other types of ag uses like storage of equipment or products, agricultural products. There is some language related to the new rural vacant or to the managed forest land, which was a part of the earlier 2008 tax bill, and that's now Class Sub 2C. A few changes are made in that classification as well. At the end of the section, there's a short rotation. Woody crops are included in the list of agricultural products. That bill has been around for a few years now, is being included here. And I think I'll leave it at that. But
let's get any addition to that. Mr. Chair, the only thing I'd like to add is I think it's fair to say that the issue of exclusively and intensively used for raising or cultivating ag products has been a huge issue for a long time. And what this bill really is trying to do is take those words out of statute and put in a broader definition, but then if it's less than 5 acres, if you look on the bill on page 45, it goes through that the assessor then looks at other factors of whether or not you qualify, and these are all ors, so you only have to qualify under one. And so that's kind of the whole thrust here, is to take those words which have been a problem and use this in those real small acreages. And I don't know if, and this has been part of the whole Green Acres and Ag discussion with Representatives Coonan and Demmer, and I don't know if he wants to say anything more about it, but this has been worked on a lot.
Okay. Section 21 is another provision partly from the veto tax bill, and it increases the class rate on the attached machine of electric generation systems from 2% to 2.4% for payable 09 and then 2.8% for payable 2010 and thereafter. This is a response to the new utility rules that are being phased in over the 2008 to 2010 period. And the difference between this bill and the vetoed bill is that this bill only makes the change for the electric generation machinery. It does not increase the class rate on the pipelines and the utility line or the electric lines that were also given a smaller increase in the tax rate. I think on the theory that they're more that this electric attached machinery generation equipment is more concentrated, and so places that have that were really more significantly affected by the utility change, whereas the other type of property is more dispersed, and the change from the utility rule could be more absorbed. Also, the effects are not uniform on that class of property. Some of those properties even had increases due to the new utility rule, and so that's the difference between the vetoed bill and this bill on that provision. Section 22 is Class 4 property, and this is generally non-homestead property. And this is the most of the Representative Loeffler's bill that reduces the class rate on the duplex and triplex non-homestead properties down to the same rates as the single-unit res non-homestead, which is 1% on the first 500,000, 1.25% on over 500,000, which is currently at a flat rate of 1.25%.
Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is there any reason why you're leaving vacant land classified as residential at its current rate of 1.25? Is there any logic behind that, or just nobody hollered about it, or what?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Earhart, I think one of the rationales that I've heard is that to keep some pressure on, you know, to develop that vacant land, not to reduce the cost of holding vacant land too low, that they wouldn't necessarily need to treat the two the same.
Well,
Representative Earhart,
Mr. Chairman, there may be a reason for not developing it for the next 5 to 10 years. Well, go ahead. I mean,
Mr. Hines, please proceed.
The next section is just a technical section which had to do with the bovine TV management credit, and that just has to do with it being on the property tax statement. Section 24, that is the third part of that bill of the chairman's. It allows county boards. Boards of review to conduct meetings on Saturday, which right now it's prohibited to even have them, even if they did want them, so it just allows them. Then it requires counties that if you conduct either regular county board meetings or open book meetings, that they have to have at least one meeting that does not end before 7 o'clock. And if they have open book meetings, if they have open book meetings, that they have to have at least one of the meetings that that they have to require some taxpayer appointments. Require taxpayer appointments to include some available times have to be extended until 7 p.m. because there are some counties that you have to make appointments in order for the county board. And that is so that the county assessors can look over the values and get ready for the taxpayers when they come in, and so they have to make these taxpayer appointments. The next whole series of sections have to do with moving up the TNT process, and it in effect got moved up about 1 month with all these changes, and the easiest thing is just to look at page 24, which has a table showing all of the effective changes. And so all of these various provisions sections 26, 27, 29, 31, 32, 33, and 34 are all just various different parts of the process that all had to sequentially be moved up as part of this. The one that is, and I might also mention that this whole process doesn't get moved up until pay 2010. So it will have a whole year to kind of work out what kind of timing and what kind of things might be able to be done by the county in order to make this process work. So it's not going to be effective for next year. The one provision that was not really part of that is Section 28, and that was a separate bill that will take effect next year, and that's just that if a taxing authority fails to certify its proposed levy by due date, the county auditor uses the authority's previous year's final levy for purposes of determining its proposed property tax notices and advertisements. That's never been officially known as to what the county auditor should do, and that specifies what the county auditor should do.
Section 30 is another provision that was in last year's house tax bill, and it requires the city or a city over 2,500 or a county that proposes a levy increase greater than a threshold that's determined under the bill to send out a supplemental proposed tax notice that sort of explains why they are increasing them above this threshold. And the threshold basically uses the previous year's levy plus aid, increased by 1%, the percentage growth in population, and the percentage increase in the market value due to new construction of commercial industrial, and the implicit price deflator. Increases levy plus aid by those factors, subtracts the amount of aid for the proposed year, and says if the levy increase is greater than that, you need to send out the supplemental notice that basically lays that all out for the taxpayer, including a description of why the jurisdiction needs to raise money above that threshold. So it doesn't limit what they can do, it just asks them to explain it further.
Members, one reason for that is when you put a lot of money into direct property tax relief, you lose a little bit of the linkage between the council setting the levy and the property taxpayer. So they can say, well, you know, this new program is going to kind of limit things to 2%, and so the more we add, it's going to be picked up from the state. And that's a legitimate concern. So what we've done here is added a supplemental notice so that there is accounting for, and so if they do go above a certain level, they have to be accountable as far as sending out information to folks as to why they're doing it and how the money's going to be used and so forth. So it is to try to keep a link as much as possible there, and I'm not insinuating there you lose that link, because certainly as a city council member or a commissioner, you are out and about in your communities all the time, and even with any of the plans, there is a copay. So none of the benefits are, you know, if the taxes are raised, you always pay a portion of those increases because we have the copay. So there, it's not like there isn't a link, but with a lot of direct aid, we just thought this was appropriate for that. Ms. Baker.
The next section is 35. That is on apportionment of proceeds to taxing districts, and that was a bill of Representative Hodge. And what this just clarifies is, and it's dealing really with apportioning special assessments, that currently everything refers to municipal subdivision. And there are special assessments that aren't just municipal. So by doing this, it really is redefining that other local governments also, since they have that authority, should get some of this distribution, and that's all this is doing. The next several sections are the Senior Citizen Property Tax Deferral Program qualifications, and this is the same provision as was in the 2007 House Omnibus, as it passed the House floor, and this was to the three real changes here are that now both spouses don't have to be 65. One has to be 65 and the other can be at least 62. It also increases the maximum threshold from 60,000 to 80,000 household income, and that's the same income that's used for property tax refund purposes. And then lastly, that there won't be interest charged on the deferred property taxes that are deferred. And so those are the three changes that were made, and like I said, this was in the bill before. The next toll series is starting with section 41, and I'm not going to go through it. This is the whole seasonal rec property tax deferral program. Also, this was in the House Omnibus Bill, and this is very, very similar to the senior deferral, except it relates to seasonal rec property, and it looks at the primary property owner, and if there's any secondary property owners, they have to have owned it for at least 15 years prior to filing this application. And what it allows them to do is defer some of the property taxes. They can defer, I think it's up to 50% of the property taxes above the base year, whatever the base year is going into the program. And this is the same as the senior program in that it puts a lien on the property so that when the deferral is terminated, and that could be either because it's sold or that the primary owner dies or the people don't want to be in the program anymore, then this has to be paid back.
One of the main reasons we did this is because a number of the comments we were receiving through the comment line and so forth was, I bought this cabin back 40 years ago. It was, you know, $20,000-$30,000. Now it's $500,000. And we want to be able to keep this to pass it on to our families. So what this does is that you can defer these 50% off the base each year until both spouses would pass away or transfer it on. So at the point you want to transfer it to your son or daughter, at that point they have to pay. But the parents right now can keep that in their ownership and so forth and pass that on to their kids if they want to. They should not be forced out because of property tax. Please proceed.
Mr. Chair, we're up to now to section 49 on page 20 of the summary. And that is a provision that Representative Lenchesky that converts the limit on economic development abatements from 10% of the levy to 10% of the tax capacity of the jurisdiction. Section 50 is a provision from Representative Medora's bill that provides that the Metro Transit levy will be levied against the entire 7-county area rather than the current levy, which is against the transit taxing district, which is the more populated parts of the 7-county area. Section 51 is a technical provision related to the transit taxing area change. Section 52 is an effective date correction, which corrects a provision in the earlier tax bill from this year, and it provides that the class rate and the tier change for the Class 1C Homestead Resort property are to take effect for taxes payable in 2009. Section 53 is a fiscal disparity study. This was from the vetoed tax bill last year, and asked the Department of Revenue or the Commissioner of Revenue to conduct a study and report back by February 1 of 2010 on the fiscal disparity program and how it's meeting its goals.
The next section, the White Community Hospital District, that is Representative Rukavina. That just allows two or more of the cities, and it lists the various cities and towns, to establish a hospital district by resolution, even though they're not contiguous to each other. And that's kind of the key here, because currently hospital district areas have to be contiguous. So that was the primary reason for having this bill, and it grants them most of the same powers that hospital districts have, and authorizes them an operating tax levy, which is in subdivision 7, and that is an amount that can't exceed, and it has an actual tax rate there, and that was kind of backed into for some dollars that Representative Rukavina was looking for that the hospital district really needed to operate, which is that $200,000. The next provision, 55, is the Badness Lake Area Water Management Organization Storm sewer utility fees, and that's a bill of Representative McFarland's. And the only thing that this really does is it provides that this organization can certify to Ramsey County, and I think there's a little bit of it in Anoka, but the vast majority is in Ramsey County, and they can extend and put those charges on the property tax statements, and it can be collected like a property tax in the same way and in the same manner and at the same time, and then Ramsey County will send those amounts back to that organization, and it also allows the auditor to charge a fee to recover the cost, because it was a very expensive thing for them to do the billing, and then if people didn't pay, what did they do? Section 56 is Representative Hillstrom's. It's a provision which was in the 2007 veto deal. It's just a pilot project for participation in the crime-free multi-housing program, and in essence, it just requires them that they have to participate in this in order to receive the 4D property classification. The Section 57, this is assessments of property of purely public charities. This section is in response to the court case, the Under the Rainbow Child Care court case versus Goodhue County. And it is a provision which addresses how purely public charities should be, how the property tax exemption for them should be determined. And in order to facilitate a review by the 2009 legislature of these nonprofits and also to develop standards and criteria for them, it requires the commissioner to conduct an analysis of standards to determine the tax status of them, and it does prohibit changes in assessment practices and policies regarding the property of these organizations. It states that the purpose is to allow the legislature to evaluate whether the judicially established rules and assessment practices and policies in applying the rules determine the tax status. Their tax status ensures public benefits are at least commensurate with the cost of the exemption. It also states the legislature does not intend in requiring the study to indicate an intention to expand or to narrow the rules for exempting these. It requires the commissioner to survey all the county assessors to get a tax status on these institutions, including some detail on organization and use, practices and policies in determining the status, and requires the commissioner to report the findings to the chairs by February 1st of 2009. Subdivision 3 actually does have a moratorium on changes and prohibits the assessor from changing current practices or policies in assessing the property unless the change is made as a result of a change in ownership, occupancy, or use, or to correct an error. They can, however, change the estimated market value if it's currently taxable property and they think that the market value needs to be adjusted. The provision expires on the earlier of either enactment of the establishment of the criteria or adjournment of the 2009 session. There are two different repealers. One is a repealer for Green Acres on the income requirement, and the second has to do with the Met Council on the levying the transit tax outside the boundaries of the district. So it's Medora's bill, and that finishes off.
Thank you very much, Ms. Baker. Mr. Hines, for article number 3. Now we will Representative Earhart. So just hold on a sec, Mr. Baker.
Mr. Chairman, I wanted to go back to article 3, section 5. Yeah. We're asking the commissioner to review local assessment practices. I thought they were doing that, and they're supposed to be doing it. There's a state assessment board, or it does not exist anymore.
Well, Ms. Baker,
Well,
right now the Department of Revenue does have supervisors for various areas of the state, but what this goes is if there is a particular, let's say a township, for example, in, let's say, Becker County, and you've got property taxpayers that say, you know, we just don't think things are operating correctly here, there's been whatever, it does give them, this is an additional avenue that they don't have, where they can officially request or petition the Department of Revenue to come in and take a look at what's happening in that area. And then the Revenue Department would have to get back a report to those citizens who ask for it.
It's my understanding now, Mr. Chairman, that there's a State Board of Assessment, and that they look at particular parcels, I don't know, townships or whatever, and to find out if their assessment ratios are greater or less than what the average should be for that. And if not proper, they order increase or decrease. Am I incorrect there?
Representative Earhart, you're right. I think the intent of this is to go beyond that, and not so much the numbers or whether or not they're hitting between the correct ratio, but more or less, and it gets back to the bill I carried. The big concern was that there needed to be a rotation of assessors, because certain assessors may become too familiar with the property owners that they are assessing, and they may give one here something versus another. That was the perception. That's not mine. That's the perception from some of the homeowners. So this is kind of an avenue that goes to things beyond the 90 to 105% ratio that they have to do. It would go to other things dealing with, you know, a favoritism or whatever that might be.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if I understand correctly, the State Board of Assessments, if that's what it's called, still is far removed from the local situation which you're talking about. Are they still not functioning, or?
Ms. Baker, can you answer that, I guess?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Earhart, the State Board does not review individual properties. What they are looking at is taxing jurisdictions, and what you're talking about, like all the sales ratios and looking at them, comparing the township, you know, the various types of property and the various areas and borders between, you know, is there much difference between two counties and the border, so that there isn't big differences between them. But they don't look at individual properties, and I think Representative Markworth's comments here are to get down one level kind of deeper, and that is some people feel that, whether it's perception or not, they feel that they really need something more to say, we really would like you to look at individual properties of what's happening here. And, you know, that isn't something I think that the Department of Revenue typically does. And so this is trying to address that.
Representative Earhart.
Mr. Chairman, it talks within a specified taxing jurisdiction. Do we still have a State Board of Estimate or whatever it's called that requires, I've seen them do it on township levels, if not smaller. Where they have told the township, you got to raise in that jurisdiction.
Yes.
You're right.
Ms. Baker?
Mr. Chair, Representative Earhart, yes. Yes, they do. And but when they do that, what they do is, if you have to raise 10% on ag property, you're raising 10% on everybody's ag property. You're not picking and choosing which ones to raise 10% on. And the reference here to the specific taxing jurisdiction is within a county, it might be two townships that the taxpayers in those two townships really feel that they've been unjustly served. And so what this is trying to address is whatever specific taxing jurisdictions are really, those people within those taxing jurisdictions are requesting the commissioner to look into it. That's what this reference here is to specific taxing jurisdictions.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, is this the same, or whatever you want to call it, unit over there going to do this? And if not, then we have to create, we have to provide more money for this?
Mr. Chair, Representative
Baker.
Earhart, I'm not sure how to answer that. It would be the Commissioner of Revenue is the one that is going to review, and what they'll probably first do is send out their regional reps and you know, discuss some of this in more detail than what has been going on right now. when they see that one particular area or two little or two townships or whatever that there's issues with. So I don't think, you know, at this point, I don't think the jury is out as to how many requests that they would even get.
And we would probably hear from the Department of Revenue on Wednesday.
Just one more question,
Representative Earhart.
Do we, Mr. Chairman, do we still have what I've been asking about all the time? Do we still have that unit in place?
Mr.
And we've not gone into hiding any place?
No.
It's still available?
No.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Earhart, yes, we still have the State Board of Assessors.
Okay.
Or State the State Board of Equalization.
Okay.
All right. We are now, thank you. Any other questions on Article 3? If not, we will head to Article 4. And that is dealing with local option sales taxes. And Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Article 4 should be very, very quick. All of these four provisions that are in Article 4 were in the veto tax bill last year. Section 1 is the moratorium on political subdivisions using money to promote or hold a referendum to support a local option sales tax, and that moratorium is in effect, would be in effect till December 31st, 2011. The one thing I forgot to mention back in the local sales tax article is that there was one change to the study, and the study will now require not only for the participants to look at the LDA or the AIDS, but also look at how the AIDS and local sales taxes should interact. So there is a connection between those. Section 2 is the Clearwater local sales tax that was in last year's veto tax bill. Section 3 is the North Mankato local sales tax that was in last year's veto tax bill. And Section 4 is the Winona local sales tax that was in last year's veto tax bill. And they are all in identical language as they were in the bill when it was sent to the governor.
Any questions on that or comments? Representative Earhart.
Mr. Chairman, I'm just wondering if that 3.5-year moratorium will lapse next year.
The reason, Representative Earhart, it is set at that is because we also want to be able to have that, as Ms. Dalton mentioned, that local government LGA study also look at this. So it's kind of, well, we look at all this, and of course, as you know, states, if you look at it, generally those that tend to have a lot of local government aid have very, very little authority of giving cities or local option sales tax versus those that hardly give any local government aid allow more. So there, I think we'll find a relationship there between LGA and local option sales taxes. But that's one of the reasons for the 3.5 years, is so we have a chance to study that also. Anyone else on any of the articles? If not, Ms. Dalton, thank you so much. Staff, thank you so much for your work and presentations. Members, I also want to thank all those in the audience who I know have had a lot of work and a lot that is in this bill, so I really do appreciate that also. A couple things before we adjourn. We will have markup on Wednesday. It will be at 6:30. I think that's a pretty time certain, 6:30. As far as amendments, they must be in, this is for the staff, so by noon on Wednesday. So for the House research, by noon on Wednesday is the deadline for amendments. And also, if you've got a bill that's already in bill form, you don't need to redo it, just put your name across it and put it in as an amendment. So you don't need to redo bills and so forth. Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did you say 6:30 Wednesday evening here?
6:30 Wednesday evening here. We'll also have markup, and also there will be opportunity for testimony also that evening, so all groups can testify on the bill. Anything else we need for the good of the order tonight? Thanks, everyone, for their patience, and we are adjourned.